Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 933. The Making of Donald Trump, subtitled Top Banana Republic, Part 2. This is being recorded on November 18th of the year 2016. This program is the second in what for the record is a new undertaking. I am in the process of reading into the record the vast bulk of a very important and yet quite short book. The book is called The Making of Donald Trump. That is the main part of the title of this program. It is authored by David K. C. A. Y. Johnston, J-O-H-N-S-T-O-N, of course, a Pulitzer Prize winner. It is published in hardcover by Melville House. That is as in Herman Melville. With Donald Trump already doing exactly what anyone who knew anything about him figured he would do, and that is trampling all over the campaign promises that he made and basically moving in the direction of fulfilling the GOP agenda from seriously watering down Medicare, Paul Ryan already talking about doing that, to appointing all sorts of monsters to his transition team, and now Jeff Sessions to be Attorney General. Basically, Trump's promises to those disaffected members of the white working class are going to be seriously betrayed, which should come as no surprise. He made all sorts of promises that he would not be able to keep. He does appear to be headed on track to seriously mess up the lives of various people of color, as well as old folks, as well as just about anybody else. This should come as no surprise to anyone familiar with Donald Trump. Trump basically was seen going into this election in a poll that I accessed in the first of these programs as being more honest than Hillary Clinton. That is really quite remarkable. An article, or really a post from the ABC News website of something that was on Good Morning America, saw Donald Trump as 46%, viewed as more honest by 46% of likely voters, with Hillary Clinton being seen as more honest by 38% of eligible voters. This is, in and of itself, I think, a remarkable comment on our institutions and our citizens. Even that article itself said Donald Trump had been caught lying several unquote times during the campaign. It was a whole lot more than several, which might imply four or five. Donald Trump has basically been doing that his entire professional life. So what I am going to be doing, what I am in the process of doing, is reading into the record, again, the book, The Making of Donald Trump by David K. Johnston, not the entire book, but most of it. It is a very short book, well written, very incisive, and I want to emphasize two things. First of all, with the holiday season coming up, I can't make a better recommendation for a holiday gift than the making of Donald Trump. It is not long. It is an easy read. It is, however, packed with very, very valuable information. It does not go into the connections of Donald Trump that I spoke about in my 10-part series about the Trump and Confabanda. Doesn't go into his fascist politics and associations, but it does give us a very incisive picture of the man who has been installed in the White House. I also want to stress that I don't get any money from this, nor do any of the stations. The stations that carry these programs. This is a public service. I'm going to plunge right in, and we're going to continue reading from Chapter 5. In Chapter 5, Donald Trump and the beginning of his association with Senator Joe McCarthy's right-hand man, red-baiting lawyer and mob associate Roy Cohn was related. And we were reading about a lawsuit brought by the federal government against Donald Trump for discriminating against people of color in the rentals for his properties. I'm going to overlap the reading of text in this program with that in the last one. The timing is really quite appropriate because today, Friday, November 18th of 2016, one of the dominant news stories is that Donald Trump settled to the tune of millions of dollars, three lawsuits that were filed against him, including one in New York State in connection with Trump University. More about Trump University in this book. What is interesting is that Trump did exactly in the lawsuit, and I will have an article about the settlement in the written description for this program. He basically admitted no wrongdoing, settled the lawsuit, and blasted the New York State Attorney General, who was one of the key figures in bringing this lawsuit. That is exactly how Donald Trump operates. And it is what he did in the lawsuit that was brought against him by the federal government for discriminating against people of color in renting the apartments in his buildings. Reading now from David K. Johnston's The Making of Donald Trump. And bear in mind, as you listen to this and as you listen to the other aspects of the presentation by David K. Johnston, and please go out and buy the book, read it, tell other people about it, talk about it on the internet, and get the word out. Again, I get no money from this, nor do any of the stations that air the program. Bear in mind that due to our badly corrupted media institutions, including the so-called progressive media, and frankly due to the fact that far too many of the American citizens basically have their heads lodged securely in the receiving entrance, so to speak, Donald Trump was seen as more honest than Hillary Clinton, which is really quite remarkable. Of the lawsuit that Roy Cohn represented Donald Trump in, and which Donald Trump lost resoundingly and had to settle, David K. Johnston writes, "Other facts pointed to Trump's wrongdoing. The government had been told by Trump employees that when blacks insisted on filling out an application at one of the whites' only Trump buildings. The applications were coded with number 9 or, quote, C, unquote. Elise, E-L-Y-S-E, Goldweber, G-O-L-D-W-E-B-E-R, the novice Justice Department lawyer, told the court that one employee who spoke to investigators was not being named because, quote, he was afraid that the Trumps would have him knocked off or words to that effect for revealing the techniques used to deny blacks and other minorities. Cohn's response was to accuse another government lawyer of soliciting false testimony and conducting Gestapo-like interrogation of Trump employees. Federal Judge Edward R. Nayer, N-E-A-H-E-R, dismissed as utterly without foundation, unquote, Cohn's claims of official misconduct. Judge Nayer also dismissed Trump's countersuit and allowed the government to proceed with the original suit and investigation, satisfied that enough evidence existed for the case to go forward. In the arch of the deal, Trump said he told Cohn, I'd rather fight than fold, because as soon as you fold once, you get the reputation, unquote, of someone who settles. But faced with a case in which neither facts nor the law were on his side, Trump folded and settled. A government press release heralded the settlement as, quote, one of the most far-reaching ever, unquote, to end racial discrimination in housing. The settlement required the running of advertisements to solicit non-white tenants and an end to all discriminatory practices, including the secret coding of rental applications. Trump handled the adverse settlement the way he had learned from his father, by spinning the news and offering a simple and quotable narrative, exploiting the fact that most reporters accurately quote what people say without understanding legal rules or regulatory practice. The settlement was a complete loss for Trump, but he spun the case as a massive win, writing, quote, in the end, the government couldn't prove its case, and we ended up making a minor settlement without admitting any guilt, unquote. The government routinely lets people who settle get off without admitting to any wrongdoing, so long as they agree to stop what they don't have to admit they were up to. Trump's takeaway from this early loss was not that times had changed and civil rights laws would be enforced. He wrote that he learned to make sure Cohn and presumably any other lawyers who followed was fully prepared when the case went to court. He also learned to place loyalty above all else. Even if he privately disagreed or if pursuing a case was not in Cohn's best interest, quote, you could count on him to go to bat for you, Trump wrote. Loyalty, he continued, was far more important than, quote, all the hundreds of respectable, unquote, guys who make careers out of boasting about their uncompromising integrity, but have absolutely no loyalty. That is, of course, the kind of perspective we expect from mobsters, dictators, and others whose primary regard is for unflinching support, not for allegiance to truth or facts. That last sentence again. The man he is talking about, of course, is President of the U.S. That is, of course, the kind of perspective we expect from mobsters, dictators, and others whose primary regard is for unflinching support, not for allegiance to truth or facts. The settlement required 2 years of federal oversight. No significant problems arose, so oversight ended. In the third year, the government filed a new complaint asserting that discrimination in rentals resumed when oversight ended. In a few years, Trump would learn that Cohn came with another benefit. Hiring him could ensure that his Manhattan construction projects moved smoothly. Among Cohen's other clients were two of America's most powerful mafia figures who controlled key unions attached to demolition and construction in New York City. As you listen to what we're about to cover in Chapter 6, again, bear in mind that an ABC News poll found that 46% of likely voters thought that Donald Trump was more honest than Hillary Clinton. 38% felt that Hillary Clinton was more honest. And also, again, as fate would have it, today, Friday, November 18th of 2016, saw Donald Trump settle with regard to the lawsuit against Trump University, something we will cover later in the book. And Trump spun that exactly as he spun the government lawsuit against him over the racial discrimination he engaged in with regard to his apartments.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at SpitfireList.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Chapter 6 of David K. Johnston's The Making of Donald Trump. Trump's most important deals. In The Art of the Deal, Trump boasts that when he applied for a casino owner's license in 1981, he persuaded the New Jersey Attorney General to limit the investigation of his background. It was perhaps the most lucrative negotiation of Trump's life, one that would embarrass state officials a decade later when Trump's involvement with mobsters, mob associates, and swindlers became clear. New Jersey required all licensed applicants to complete a highly detailed personal history under a system designed to fulfill the promise to New Jersey voters that Atlantic City would not become a mob-run Las Vegas East. Applicants had to fill out about 50 pages of details, including every address where they had lived in the past decade, any insurance claims of more than $100,000, extensive details on their business dealings, and any government investigations, civil or criminal. The state was so diligent in vetting would-be casino owners that it sent detectives overseas to interview people and inspect documents. Trump was told in advance that investigations took about 18 months. Unwilling to endure such a lengthy inquiry, Trump set about arranging special terms to prevent scrutiny of his past, a practice he has continued to this day. First, instead of going to state government offices in Trenton, Trump asked John Degnan, D-E-G-N-A-N, the New Jersey Attorney General, to come to him. Degnan and G. Michael Brown, the head of the Division of Gaming Enforcement, traveled to the Short Hills office of Nick Ribis, R-I-B-I-S, a New Jersey lawyer Trump had hired at the recommendation of billionaire publisher Cy S.I. Newhouse. Trump assured Degnan there was no need for a long inquiry into his conduct and business dealings. He was clean as a whistle, unquote. Too young at age 35 to have become enmeshed in any sort of trouble. Trump then told him that unless the Attorney General expedited approval, he would not build in Atlantic City, where he had already acquired a prime piece of land at the center of the boardwalk. Finally, Trump hinted that his Grand Hyatt Hotel, next to Grand Central Terminal in Midtown Manhattan, could accommodate its own casino. Given Trump's well-known success in convincing the city of New York to perform lucrative favors, that was a subtle but powerful threat. If New York state lawmakers authorized casinos in the Empire State, it would draw a disastrous amount of business away from Atlantic City, more than 125 miles south of Manhattan. Dignan, by the way, is D-E-G as in George, N-A-N, was about to make his own run for New Jersey governor. He knew that the Trump lawsuit, a Trump campaign for casinos in New York, or denunciations from Trump about excessive government regulation would not win him any votes. He agreed to Trump's terms. He did not promise approval, but did promise that if Trump cooperated, the investigation would be over within 6 months. Trump paid Dignan back by becoming a vocal opponent of gambling anywhere in the East except Atlantic City. Nonetheless, Dignan lost his gubernatorial bid. Of course, Trump was not clean as a whistle by the standards of the New Jersey Casino Control Commission, even though he has still never been indicted, much less convicted of any crime. The casino license application asked whether Trump had, quote, ever been the subject of an investigation by a government agency for any reason, unquote. He had, but the DGE report made no mention of two such cases and dealt with two others in a footnote, making it clear that Trump did not include them when he submitted his application. The first investigation was a 1979 federal grand jury inquiry into how he had obtained an option to buy the Penn Central Railroad yards on the west side of Manhattan. FBI agents interviewed Trump twice, telling him the second time that he was a target of the grand jury. The tip that launched the investigation by Ed Corman, then the U.S. attorney in Brooklyn, came just before the 5-year statute of limitations was about to run out. Corman's probe was not complete when the deadline came. No charges were filed. In 1980, John Martin, the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, briefly investigated Trump's deal to acquire the old Commodore Hotel, which was remade into the Grand Hyatt in Midtown Manhattan. The issue again involved the Penn Central Yards, which, together with the Commodore, were owned by the bankrupt residue of the old Penn Central Transportation Company. At stake was whether the Commodore deal cheated the debtors in the bankruptcy case. No charges were filed. A third omission was the FBI's questioning Trump about his dealings with John Cody, C-O-D-Y, the mob associate with 3 felony convictions and 5 other arrests, who, as local head of the Teamsters Union, controlled the flow of ready-mix concrete in New York City. Law enforcement reports described Cody as a very close associate of the Gambino crime family. Cody had a history of getting free apartments from builders who wanted to avoid trouble from labor unions. Agents had heard that Cody sought a freebie apartment from Trump. Trump denied it. No charges were ever filed. The fourth case was the Justice Department's 1973 suit accusing Trump of racial discrimination in the rental of Trump apartments, prompting the unsuccessful countersuit filed by lawyer Roy Cohn. Casino owner applicants were asked about being accused of any civil misconduct, which would include racial discrimination in housing. Trump checked the no box. Trump had to know that failing to reveal these matters would make him ineligible to own a casino if investigators found out that he had not been candid. The cover of the application declared in large capital letters, "Failure to answer any question completely and truthfully will result in denial of your license application." This standard has been strictly enforced for other people. The prevailing legal case, which established how firmly the standard could be applied, involved an early applicant for a blackjack dealer's license, one of the lowest level licenses. The woman was rejected as morally unfit. Her offense? As a teenage cashier, she had admitted to a misdemeanor for giving friends discounts on the fence she left off her dealer's license application. After completing its investigation of Trump in a record 5 months, the Division of Gaming Enforcement report gave the ruling body, the Casino Control Commission, no hint that Trump had been the focus of multiple federal criminal investigations. Two of these cases had been in the newspapers. The reporter who broke the story, Wayne Barrett, B-A-R-R-E-T-T, was questioned by the DGE as part of the application investigation. Why the final report omitted these facts is a mystery. The DGE gave Trump a pass on his failure to disclose. In a footnote to its 119-page report, the DGE said that just before completing its work, Trump had, quote, volunteered, unquote, the information he had failed to disclose. It was an early sign of what two casino control commissioners would later say was a pattern of DGE favoritism to Donald Trump. But there was much more that the commissioners who had to vote on each license didn't know. Beginning 3 years earlier, in 1978, Trump had hired mobbed-up construction firms to erect Trump Tower. Instead of building a high-rise skeleton of steel girders, Trump chose ready-mix concrete. He did so at a time when other New York developers, notably the Lefrak, L-E-F-R-A-K, and Resnick families, R-E-S-N-I-K, were pleading with the FBI to free them from a mob-run concrete cartel that jacked up prices. Ready-mix concrete was a curious choice at the time. The liquid stone had to be rushed to construction sites and poured quickly to avoid costly problems like hardening in its rotating steel drums or not being wet enough to retain strength as it dried. Using ready-mix made developers vulnerable to union work stoppages, as Trump would later acknowledge. The Teamsters controlled the trucks delivering the ready-made mix. The construction unions controlled the construction site gate. The concrete workers and carpenters controlled the pouring and making of forms. At the top, the mob controlled the unions and rigged their elections as a federal labor racketeering trial brought by federal prosecutor Rudy Giuliani, later proved. This last one, again, because Giuliani is not only very close to Donald Trump and part of his transition team, he is being seriously considered for a cabinet post. At the top, the mob controlled the unions and rigged their elections as a federal labor racketeering trial brought by federal prosecutor Rudy Giuliani later proved. Trump favored concrete. The material has its advantages, like avoiding the costly fireproofing required for steel girders. Trump used ready-mix not just for the 58-story Trump Tower, but also his 39-story Trump Plaza apartment building on East 61st Street, his Trump Plaza Casino Hotel in Atlantic City, and other buildings. Trump bought his Manhattan ready-mix from a company called S&A Concrete. Mafia chieftains Anthony Fat Tony Salerno and Paul Castellano, C-A-S-T-E-L-L-A-N-O, secretly owned S&A Concrete. S&A charged the inflated prices that Lefrak and Resnick families complained about, Lefrak to both law enforcement and the New York Times. As Barrett noted, by choosing to build with ready-mix concrete rather than other materials, Trump put himself, quote, at the mercy of a legion of concrete racketeers, unquote. But having an ally in Roy Cohn mitigated Trump's concerns. With Cohn as his fixer, Trump had no worries that the mafia bosses would have the unions stop work on Trump Tower. Salerno and Castellano were Roy Cohn's clients. Indeed, when the cement workers struck in the summer of 1982, the concrete continued to flow at Trump Tower. Years later, Barrett, the first reporter to seriously examine Trump's business practices, was able to expose some of Trump's dealings. Barrett enjoyed the deep trust of numerous local, state, and federal law enforcement sources. He reported that two witnesses observed Trump meeting at Cohn's townhouse with Salerno, an association that itself could have cost Trump his casino owner's license. When the Salerno meeting became public knowledge, the BGE did not seek out the witness who, though unnamed, any detective could have identified easily. Or, if it did, its report gave no hint of such an inquiry. Instead, the BGE put Trump under oath. He denied meeting Tony Salerno. Case closed. Just as revealing was Trump's association with John Cody, C-O-D-Y, the corrupt head of Teamsters Local 282. Cody, under indictment when he ordered the citywide strike in 1982, directed that concrete deliveries continue to Trump Tower. Cody told Barrett, "Donald liked to deal with me through Roy Cohn," unquote. Cody's son Michael told me that his father was both a loving dad and every bit the notorious racketeer people believed him to be. He said that as a boy he listened in when Trump called his father, imploring Cody to make sure concrete flowed steadily at Trump Tower so he would not go broke before it was finished. While Cody did not get a Trump Tower apartment as the FBI suspected, an especially gorgeous woman friend of Cody's did. She had no known job and attributed her lavish lifestyle to the kindness of friends. She bought three Trump Tower apartments directly under the triplex where Donald and his then-wife Ivana lived. John Cody invested $100,000 in the woman's apartments and stayed there often. Trump helped the woman get a $3 million mortgage to pay for the three apartments, one of which she modified to include the only indoor swimming pool in Trump Tower. She said she got the mortgage from a bank that Trump recommended she use without filling out a loan application or showing financials. Try that sometime. This last sentence again. She said that she got the mortgage from a bank that Trump recommended she use without filling out a loan application or showing financials. After Cody was convicted of racketeering, imprisoned, and no longer in control of the union, Trump sued the woman for $250,000 for alteration work. She countersued for $20 million. Her court papers accused Trump of taking kickbacks from contractors. They further asserted that this could, quote, be the basis of a criminal proceeding, unquote, against Trump if the state attorney general were to investigate. Trump, who insists in his presidential campaign that he never settles lawsuits because that just encourages more of them, quickly settled. He paid the woman $500,000. He has testified that he hardly knew those involved and that there was nothing improper in his dealings with either the woman or John Cody. Federal prosecutors soon brought a major case against eight mobsters. The charges included inflating the price of concrete for Trump's East 61st Street apartment building. In 1986, Salerno and seven others, including the head of the Concrete Workers Union, were convicted in a racketeering trial that included murder, payoffs, and inflated prices for concrete. The chief trial prosecutor, Michael Chertoff, C-H-E-R-T-O-F-F, told the judge that the defendants, quote, were directing the largest and most vicious criminal business in the history of the U.S. By the way, parenthetically, Michael Chertoff was not only the head of the Department of Homeland Security under George W. Bush, he was an advisor to Donald Trump during his campaign. And again, he was involved with the prosecution of many of Trump's top organized crime associates. Continuing with the making of Donald Trump. Even after he got his casino license, Trump continued to have relationships that should have prompted inquiries by the casino investigators. In 1988, Trump made a deal to put his name on Trump Golden Series and Trump Executive Series limousines, as reporter Bill Bastone, B-A-S-T-O-N-E, first revealed. In addition to a TV with a video cassette player and a fax machine, each limo had two telephones, stemware, and a handy liquor dispenser were nestled in rosewood cabinets. A hood ornament melded the Trump and Cadillac brands. The limos were modified at the Billinger Coach Works, which was owned by a pair of convicted felons. The first was convicted extortionist Jack Schwartz. The other was convicted thief John Staluppi, S-T-A-L-U-P-P-I, a multimillionaire Long Island car dealer identified in FBI reports and other law enforcement documents as a soldier in the Colombo crime family. New Jersey regulators, who claimed to oversee the most highly regulated industry in American history, did nothing when Trump made his deal with Staluppi and Schwartz to sell the Trump-branded Cadillacs. New York liquor regulators proved to be much tougher. They denied Staluppi's application for a liquor license because of his rap sheet and his extensive dealings with mobsters, including some common friends who provided Trump with his helicopters, as we shall see. I'm going to skip chapter 7 of the book. I mean, it is very interesting and revealing about the way Trump operates, but is not as important, I think, as some of the other aspects of this particular book. Again, please go out, buy the book, read it, and tell other people about it, and spread the word on the internet and through other means of communication. Now, bear in mind, again, that an ABC News poll found that 46% of likely voters found Donald Trump to be more honest, and 38% found Hillary Clinton to be more honest. And we're going to take a look at what Donald Trump has been up to. Keep that in mind.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Chapter 8, Showing Mercy. Among the assorted criminals with whom Trump did business over more than three decades, his most mysterious dealings involved a drug trafficker named Joseph Weichselbaum, W-E-I-C-H-S-E-L-B-A-U-M. Trump did unusual favors for this three-time felon, repeatedly putting his lucrative casino license at risk to help a major cocaine and marijuana trafficker for reasons that remain unfathomable. the Brooklyn-born Weichselbaum, 4 years older than Trump, was well-known in Miami cigarette boat-racing circles where narcotics, traffickers, and white-collar felons often mixed. He piloted boats named Mighty Mouse and Nuts and Bolts in races off the Florida coast. He came in third at a 1973 race behind Charles F. Keating, K-E-A-T-I-N-G, a Cincinnati lawyer who later went to prison in the Lincoln Savings and Loan Association swindle that cost taxpayers $2 billion. Trump met Joey Weichselbaum through Steve Hyde, the portly Mormon elder who ran Trump's Atlantic City casinos in 1986. At the time, Weichselbaum was already a twice-convicted felon. His first offense was grand theft auto in 1965. His second was embezzlement in 1979. A judge ordered Weichselbaum to return $135,000 to S&S Corrugated Paper Machinery, a Brooklyn firm at which he had worked for a decade. Weichselbaum and his younger brother Franklin, who has never been charged with a crime, launched a New Jersey-based helicopter service in 1982. Many more experienced firms offered helicopter services, but in 1984, the Weichselbaum brothers landed the primary contract to ferry high rollers to and from Trump casinos. Their fleet served other casinos as well, but their main client was Trump. The brothers' company also maintained Trump's personal helicopter, a black Eurocopter AS-332 Super Puma he named Ivana after his wife at the time. That was valued by Trump at $10 million. And Joey Weichselbaum was not the only felon Trump selected to provide helicopter services for high rollers. He also retained Billinger Charter Services, whose owners included John Staluppi, S-T-A-L-U-P-P-I, again we talked about him in the last chapter, identified in law enforcement reports as a member of the Gambino crime family. The brothers Weichselbaum called their firm Damon, D-A-M-I-N, Aviation. Joey's title was General Manager. Damon Aviation was part of a convoluted financial arrangement that included Alan Turteltaub, T-U-R-T-L-E-T-A-U-B, founder of a high-interest rate second mortgage firm called The Money Store. A Turteltaub company bought the helicopters and then resold them to an intermediary firm who in turn leased them to Damon Aviation. The deal required little, if any, cash, thanks to a combination of tax shelter financing and tax-free bonds provided by the New Jersey Economic Development Administration. Damon soon filed for bankruptcy and reorganized as NIMAD, N-I-M-A-D, Damon, D-A-M-I-N, spelled backward. The new firm kept Trump's business, which is not unusual in itself. When a debtor retains possession of a firm, as the Weichselbaums did, the debtor often retains contracts with customers. But the firm went bankrupt again and again reorganized, this time as American Business Aviation. Why did Trump Plaza continue to pay $100,000 per month and Trump's Castle $80,000 a month for helicopter services from a firm that was so financially unstable when Trump could have hired any of its better financed and more experienced contractors? One obvious question is whether Weichselbaum was perhaps providing some other valuable service, sub rosa. Trump himself was no drug user. He didn't even drink or smoke. But it was open knowledge in Atlantic City that high rollers could get anything they wanted as long as it was done discreetly. For those who brought lots of cash, signed the big markers, or were assigned complimentary suites. Certain butlers were known to provide for a price whatever the customer wanted, be it illicit sex, drugs, or anything else. As a state casino lawyer told me shortly after I arrived in New York, in Atlantic City in 1988, quote, "We regulate what goes on involving gaming, not what people do in the privacy of hotel rooms," unquote. Another glaring question is whether Trump financed any of Weichselbaum's activities. Trump was known to be an avid investor seeking big returns, whether through greenmailing competing casino companies, buying controlling shares in rival casino companies and selling back those shares at a higher price, or using Roy Cohn's influence with mob-owned companies and mob-controlled unions. Joey Weichselbaum's pay and perks were unusual. Even though he had officially left the twice-failed helicopter company, Weichselbaum continued to receive his $100,000 annual salary. He also retained his company car and driver. All the while, Weichselbaum was deeply involved in drug trafficking in Florida, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee, according to his 1985 indictment by a federal grand jury in Cincinnati. One shipment also involved 0.75 tons of marijuana. In addition to his helicopter business, Joey Weichselbaum was an officer at a used car dealership north of Miami, Bradford Motors, which he also owned in partnership with his brother. Bradford, by the way, B-R-A-D-F-O-R-D. Continuing. Couriers from Colombia delivered drugs there, which were sometimes sold on the spot. According to the indictment, Weichselbaum put cocaine in vehicles himself or handed it over to couriers who delivered it to buyers. The dealership, essentially a front for drug trafficking, paid phony commissions for the sale of cars in an effort to hide the real business, as court records show. As a casino owner in Atlantic City, Trump had every reason to avoid business dealings with known criminals, which Weichselbaum was even before the drug trafficking and tax evasion charges in Cincinnati. Under the New Jersey Casino Control Act, Trump and all casino owners were, quote, required to establish by clear and convincing evidence his or her good character, honesty, and integrity. Such information shall include without limitation information pertaining to family, habits, character, reputation, criminal and arrest record, business activities, financial affairs and business, professional and personal associates, unquote. Yet instead of dropping the helicopter service, Trump retained American Business Aviation for his casino shuttles and to service his personal helicopter. Trump later acquired 3 helicopters when he divvied up the old Resorts International Casino Company in a deal with entertainer Merv Griffin. Trump got the unfinished Taj Mahal Casino Hotel, Merv the aging Resorts Hotel, the original Atlantic City Casino. Despite having these three choppers, Trump kept paying more than $2 million per year for Weichselbaum copters. 2 months after Weichselbaum was indicted, the Weichselbaum brothers rented apartment 32C at the Trump Plaza condominiums on East 61st Street in Manhattan. Trump personally owned apartment 32C. The rental terms were unusual. Rent was $7,000 per month, which was at the low end of a reasonable rate. The brothers paid $3,000 a month in cash, using checks made out to Donald J. Trump personally, and paid the rest in helicopter services. Short of a costly forensic audit, it will be impossible for any law enforcement agency, including New Jersey casino regulators, to ascertain whether the brothers actually paid any more than the cash rent. Just what motivated Trump to agree to this arrangement has never been explained. When Weichselbaum made a deal with prosecutors to plead guilty to one of the 18 counts in the Cincinnati case, something very suspicious happened. His case was transferred out of Ohio for the guilty plea and the sentencing. Logically, the case might have gone to South Florida, where Bradford Motors was located, or to New York, where Weichselbaum lived. Indeed, that is exactly what Weichselbaum's Ohio lawyer, Arnold Morelli, M-O-R-E-L-L-I, saw in a January 30, 1986 motion requesting that his case be transferred to either Manhattan or Miami for, quote, the convenience of human beings such as the defendant and witnesses, unquote. Instead, the Weichselbaum case was moved to New Jersey. There, it was assigned to Judge Marianne Trump Berry, Donald Trump's older sister. Judge Berry recused herself 3 weeks later as judicial ethics required, but the mere act of removing herself from the case came with a powerful message. A sitting federal judge, as well as her husband, lawyer John Berry, and family, repeatedly flew in helicopters connected to a major drug trafficker. Any new judge assigned to the case, including the district's presiding judge, was on notice that this case had the potential to embarrass the bench. When Judge Harold A. Ackerman replaced Trump's sister, Trump wrote him a letter seeking leniency for Weichselbaum on the drug trafficking charge. Trump characterized the defendant as, quote, a credit to the community, unquote, and described Weichselbaum as, quote, conscientious, forthright, and diligent, unquote, in his dealings with the Trump Plaza and Trump's Castle casinos. When asked about the letter under oath in a private 1990 meeting with New Jersey Division of Gaming Enforcement lawyers, Trump testified that he could not recall whether, quote, he had written any letters of reference to the federal judge who sentenced Weichselbaum, unquote. Subsequently, the division obtained such a letter, and Trump acknowledged that it bore his signature. 2 years later, the DGE had to explain itself publicly after journalist Wayne Barrett's unauthorized 1992 biography of Trump revealed the letter. The DGE, citing my reporting on the issue, published a report on 14 issues raised by Barrett. Its report said nothing about what would prompt Trump to write such a letter, whether he actually believed what he wrote, and what his purpose was in writing it. The DGE lawyers merely recorded Trump's denial, then later his admission that he had in fact signed the letter. That was atypical of the DGE lawyers, who declined again and again to ask probing questions that might raise deeper issues about Trump's fitness to hold a license. Likewise, the DGE's response to Barrett's book did not request an explanation of the unusual terms under which Trump rented an apartment he personally owned to the Weichselbaum brothers. As with other matters, like the accusations made by high roller Bob Libuti, L-I-B-U-T-T-I, the DGE took Trump at his word and avoided questions that might require more investigation. Judge Ackerman gave Weichselbaum a sentence that stood in stark contrast to the sentences levied on the others named in his Cincinnati indictment. The small fish got sentences of up to 20 years. Weichselbaum, the ringleader, got 3. He served only 18 months. When he was up for early release, Wechselbaum told his parole officer that he already had work lined up. He was Donald Trump's new helicopter consultant. He also said he would be moving into Trump Tower. While he was behind bars, Wechselbaum's girlfriend bought two adjoining 39th-story Trump Tower apartments, numbered 49A and 49B, because Trump skipped 10th-floor numbers to inflate the apartment height of his signature building erected a few years earlier. The price was $2.4 million. Trump confirmed to the DGE that he believed Wechselbaum moved into Trump Tower and lived with a girlfriend after he was released from prison, but said he had no contact with him except for seeing him in the building. And we will finish this chapter. Note that with regard to the vacancy on the Supreme Court, Donald Trump said that he felt someone like his sister, Marianne Trump Berry, would be an ideal appointment. Note also the involvement with Rudy Giuliani and Michael Chertoff, two Trump advisors, in some of the organized crime-connected cases that Trump had been involved with, that involved associates of Trump.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
We're going to conclude this program. I'm going to read once again the poem, Be Angry at the Sun, by Robinson Jeffers. That public men publish falsehoods is nothing new. That America must accept, like the historical republics, corruption and crime has been known for years. Be angry at the sun for setting if these things anger you. Watch the wheel slope and turn. They are all bound on the wheel, these people, those warriors, this republic, Europe, and Asia. Observe them gesticulating. Observe them going down. The gang serves lies. The passionate man plays his part. The cold passion for truth hunts in no pack. You are not catalysts, you know, to lampoon these crude sketches of Caesar. You are far from Dante's feet, but even farther from his dirty political hatreds. That boys want pleasure, and men struggle for power, and women perhaps for fame, and the servile to serve a leader, and the dupes to be duped. Yours is not theirs. This concludes For the Record 933, The Making of Donald Trump, subtitled Top Banana Republic, Part 2, being recorded on November 18th of 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.